This is Dr. Michael Bricky with Ageless Lifestyles Radio, cutting-edge thinking for being youthful at every age. On each program, I interview experts on what it takes to live longer, healthier, and happier. Our program takes a holistic approach in addressing anti-aging psychology, medicine, alternative medicine, fitness, nutrition, and wellness. Our emphasis is on innovative thinking and practices that have solid data and results. Dr. Ruth Ann Russo takes a very holistic approach to healthcare. Recently on Ageless Lifestyles Radio, she shared with us her advocacy strategies for getting what you need from doctors and hospitals and insurance companies. In addition to her book, 7 Steps to Your Best Possible Healthcare, she's done a very balanced study of the raw food movement. Her brand new book, matter of fact, it won't be out for 2 weeks, The Raw Food Diet Myth. Frankly, I don't know much about raw foods, but I trust Dr. Russo's even-handed research. I also recently had a friend tell me how he's gotten into raw foods and loves raw ice cream, which I'd never heard of. When I read Dr. Russo's book, The Raw Food Diet Myth, I was very impressed with how instead of evangelizing for a movement, she gently makes the case from the perspective that most people who would consider raw food want to gradually wade in and pick and choose what makes sense to them. 10 years ago, organic foods were hard to find. Now we have supermarkets like Whole Foods, and many mainstream grocery stores have organic food sections. Wouldn't surprise me if 10 years from now, the raw food options are just as common as the organic food options. We'll start with some baby steps that you might take in using raw food for better health, and we'll work our way up to some of the interesting controversies and how raw foods can help with diseases like cancer and diabetes, and even enhance your spirituality. Dr. Russo, welcome.
Thank you, Dr. Bricky. I'm happy to be here.
First, the book title. When I saw it and I saw Diet Myth, I thought, oh, is she going to debunk the raw food movement? What's the myth part?
The myth part is that this is actually not a diet. It's really the raw and living food lifestyle. And so it really permeates a lot more than just what you eat when you take a look at the whole perspective.
Let's start with a baby step. I'm going to have broccoli for dinner tonight. Why should I eat that raw instead of put it in the microwave or steam it?
That's a great question. The primary reason for that, and this is essentially the rationale behind the raw food diet and lifestyle, is because there are something called enzymes in food. And when you cook your food, these enzymes are destroyed. Now, the reason you don't want to destroy them and you want them to remain in your food is because the enzymes actually can play a significant part in your own digestive process. The enzymes can essentially take over for some of the work of your digestive system and allow not only your digestive system, but the rest of your body to take care of what it needs to take care of. Today, so many of us, with the diets that we eat on the run, fast food, etc., we're causing our bodies to spend so much time digesting that we're ignoring a lot of the other parts of our bodies, and in many instances may end up with some chronic conditions or just other sort of nagging issues that we might not have otherwise had if we were spending a little bit more time making better food choices, like eating raw broccoli.
So how did mainstream nutrition miss the emphasis on enzymes?
I think part of it is, to be honest with you, is that when you think of the concept of raw anything, just the word raw, I mean, generally, you know,
not appealing.
Well, the main question that I get is, oh, so you mean sushi? As soon as people hear raw, they're thinking it's raw fish. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's generally just a lack of acceptance in mainstream of this entire concept. So that's potentially part of it, seeing, oh, well, if you're a raw foodist, that's, you know, a cult-like kind of living. I do think that's part of it. And I think the other part of it is just a cultural perspective, which is, for how many centuries now have we been cooking our food? And that's just the way we do it. There's also some arguments out there that say food is better cooked. But when you look at the research, what you find is that essentially, with one exception, and that is in some nuts and seeds, you actually do need to soak them before you eat them. But with that only exception, fresh fruits and vegetables are better for you than cooked fruits and vegetables. We talk a lot about the specifics that back that up in the book as well.
We've known about enzymes for a long time. Is it just that the big food companies didn't want to deal with it because it didn't fit well with preservatives that would give food good shelf life?
I think that's a reasonable assumption to make. And I think one of the things that you have to think about is just how our entire lives are structured and the fact that we go to the grocery store and what 80 to 90% of the grocery store is filled with foods that have a shelf life of 6 months, sometimes a year or more. And those types of foods would certainly not be conducive to anyone who is practicing a raw food lifestyle.
If someone never has digestive problems, are they still going to benefit from having more enzymes from raw foods?
In general, you can say yes. Myself, as an example, I have never had any health issues. That wasn't part of the reason that I personally began to eat raw foods. But I found a significant increase in my amount of energy, a little bit of a weight change for me. Most people claim that they lose a lot of weight when they go onto the raw food lifestyle. And I think that's pretty common. But if you're already at a pretty good weight, you're not going to be in a situation where you're losing too much weight. But I found a huge impact on my energy level. That was probably where I think I had the greatest benefit. And a lot of the people that I talk about in the book, who were people that I used as sources of the research for the book, found that same thing. Many people choose the raw food lifestyle because they or someone in their family is experiencing a health problem.
Which is what got you started was your daughter?
Correct. It was my daughter, Emily, who is 21 now, but at the time she was 19. She was diagnosed with epilepsy, and she was treated as we, you know, conventional medicine today, we treat epilepsy for the most part, especially the kind she has, which is a generalized type of epilepsy. We treat that with medication to stop the seizures, and that is traditional mainstream Western medicine, and of course that's important. You want to make sure that you're stopping seizures, but what we don't do is we don't really look behind the symptom, whether there's a cause for that. Is there something we could be doing differently? And so we got a little frustrated with the amount of medication she was on, and she wasn't necessarily feeling like herself, and we began to look for some alternative steps that we could take. And we found the Raw Food Diet book by Natalia Rose in one of the Barnes & Noble stores, read it, and we were just mesmerized by it, and ended up going to a raw food cafe outside of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and tried it for the first time. And I will tell you that my daughter Emily was very, very intrigued with the whole concept, well, a teenager at the time, and thought it would be an interesting thing to try out. And since she has been eating a raw food diet, she has not had one seizure.
And this is grandma epilepsy?
Correct.
Wow.
Correct. She was having them every couple of weeks, and that's a lot for anybody's brain to take. And she's actually now also started in the last year to reduce her medication, and we're seeing a lot of success with that. And interestingly enough, the physicians originally said you'll have to take medication for the rest of your life. This type of epilepsy must be treated with medication, and they've been shocked. They are actually now very interested in at least learning more about the raw food lifestyle based upon the kinds of successes that she's had.
So she was taking medication and still having the seizures, and the raw food caused her to stop having the seizures, and now you're reducing the meds.
Correct. That's absolutely right.
You mentioned a lot of people lose weight. Is that just because if you're eating more vegetables, you're not taking in as many calories before you get full?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I think the other thing is that when you're eating living foods, it's a high energy type of food that you're eating. So if you're eating these types of foods, you probably are more likely to burn the food quicker so that you actually end up with a little bit of a heightened metabolism. There's not specific research out there to prove that particular point, but that's at least what it appears to be. There's a lot of famous folks out there who have published books who have written about this, people like Carol Alt and Woody Harrelson, and they seem to have found that type of thing happening when they went to the raw food lifestyle.
I don't normally think of celery and broccoli and lettuce as high-energy foods. What do you mean by high-energy?
What I mean by high-energy in the raw food lifestyle, the term that is used is the vibration of the food, and that's actually a common term that is used by quantum physics today as well. A lot of ways these things almost dissect each other or transect each other. So essentially what I mean by high-energy food is if you look at living foods like broccoli, something that is as close to its original living state as possible. So, for example, if you were to pick off a couple of pieces of broccoli and ate that right out of your garden, the vibration of that broccoli would be higher than the vibration of the broccoli that you bought at the grocery store that may have also been fresh, organic, and not cooked. And the way that the vibration is actually measured, or one of the common ways, is something called Carillion photography. I don't know if you're familiar with that or have...
I've read about it.
And a lot of that is quantum physics. Those folks are into this as well. But it's a type of photography that was developed by a Russian scientist back in the 1950s. He and his wife were actually involved in some of the X-ray research activities and stumbled upon the ability to measure the level of energy. And they first found that by taking pictures, for example, of things that people, rather, different parts of a person's body that were diseased. And what they found was when they took a picture of that part of the person's body, they had no light rays, so to speak, around it. But yet when they took a picture of another healthy person, especially somebody who was a raw foodist, so to speak, they saw light rays around that. And what they've been able to show is actually the higher degree of energy or vibration that something, whether it's living or something we would consider to be living or not living, the higher degree of energy that that particular thing has, the more of these light rays that kind of gather around it. And David Wolf has a great book. He has several great books, actually, The Sun Food Diet, Success System, and Eating for Beauty. And he actually has pictures in all of his books that were taken of cooked broccoli, for example, versus raw broccoli. And you see this bright color, and you see light rays all around the uncooked broccoli. And the cooked broccoli is a darker color, and there's little to no light rays around it.
This is the part that, for me, is a leap of faith. I know there's all kinds of radio waves and TV waves and cell phone waves and everything, so I know that just because you can't see it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. But maybe I need to see more photographs or something, but it's hard for me to think of that broccoli as having these waves that change if you cook it.
All I can say is that when you do look at the actual pictures themselves, that is helpful. And I've actually heard David Wolf speak in several lectures about the process and some of the uses of the Carillion photography. And he's just one. There are, you know, several others as well who speak about that process. But yeah, you're right. I mean, it is, to a certain extent, somewhat of a leap of faith. But I think what it really comes down to is just yourself. It's using yourself as an experiment. How do you feel if you eat 5 servings of broccoli in a given week, let's say, instead of 5 servings of potato chips, or I don't know what, you know, depending on what your current diet is.
Mm-hmm.
And for some of us, may have a good solid diet with lots of fruits and vegetables, and maybe they're cooked. Maybe there might not be as much of a change, but there still will be a change. And I will tell you that before we started eating the raw food way, and our entire family did that to support my daughter, and it's been very successful for all of us. Before that, I was first a vegetarian and then a vegan, so it wasn't a big leap for me to go to the raw food. I saw change, but my husband, who was a meat eater, ate quite a bit of junk food. For him, it was astounding. You know, lost like 30 pounds. Even the color in his face went from being sort of like a light kind of pasty color to almost looking like he spent time in the sun year-round, and he doesn't ever spend time in the sun. So it really comes down to each individual and giving it a try. And I'm not suggesting that we all go the whole raw food diet lifestyle, but maybe experiment with one thing. Go for a week and see how do you feel.
I think you have a terrible marketing problem. The term raw is kind of a negative term. Vegetable is an insult to people. And if you have the photography, and also the before and after photography, you ought to have that all over these magazines that have the beautiful color pictures, and then people start believing it.
Yeah, and that's actually a really good point. And I think if we could pull some of that into mainstream a little bit more, the photography and pictures of people who, before they were eating raw and after they were eating raw, some of them are just phenomenal.
You said that food processing removes magnesium from olives and peanuts and avocados. I didn't know there was any processing to olives and peanuts. What's going on there?
Most olives, there's some level of heat that's applied to them so that they're using the heat to remove some sort of pesticide type of thing, but there's minimally heat that's applied. And then depending on what's happening with the food itself, like, for example, peanuts, let's say, dry roasted, they may have salt applied to them. In that salting process, they're going through some type of processing as well. The other type of process that they may be going through, and again, you'd have to almost really look at each of the cans in terms of the ingredients, and that'll give you a little bit of a better idea. But oftentimes, especially with olives, you'll find some type of chemical may be added as a preservative to the olives. They also will have vinegar in most. And I don't think they actually use many chemicals in most of the nut-based types of foods, but you will find heat, the salting applied to them.
So how would you get a healthy olive these days?
Two things. One is you want to look for organic olives, which are fairly easy to find, especially if you can shop at a place like a Whole Foods. However, even at a place like Whole Foods, most of the olives that you will find will, in fact, have some level of food processing applied to them, even if they are organic. You'll find most of them are packed in vinegar, and vinegar is a highly acidic food, so you do want to be careful about the amount of acid that you take into your body. Ideally, what you're looking for are oil-cured organic olives, which in a place like Whole Foods can be found in the fresh olive section. You know, olive bars, how a lot of the grocery stores have those these days. In a lot of the stores that are more organically focused, you can find oil-cured organic olives, and that would be the way to go if you want a good, solid, healthy olive.
So a nice baby step would be to try some organic olives and see if they taste different and make you feel different.
Absolutely, yeah.
You also quibbled about salt. Regular table salt has some iodine added because too many Americans had goiters from iodine deficiency. What's wrong with table salt?
The biggest issue with table salt is the amount of processing that the salt itself has gone through. And so ideally, if you can be using salt that is not refined, we usually use the term refined when we talk about sugar, but you know, all of our white products pretty much are refined. And so, in essence, what has happened is that you've taken a food like salt that can actually give you some significant amount of nutrients, and you're removing all of that. And, of course, even with the salt that we use today, we're only benefiting from that because we're adding something back in. So if you can actually find an unprocessed salt, what you'll be getting is some additional minerals can be used in a supportive way for your body. Sort of one caveat to the whole salt discussion, and that is you will find in this raw food lifestyle world that there is a fairly significant amount of controversy around whether or not we want to use salt to begin with. You know, I think all of us are a little aware of some of the general controversy around salt, but when you get into the folks who actually practice this lifestyle, there's some significant banters back and forth about that.
And salt isn't naturally white?
In most cases, it's not. The salts that we use, that I've actually started to use, and have found them to be a lot more palatable, and I can't tell you for sure that the use of a particular salt has made me feel in a certain particular way or anything like that, but the salt that we use is a Himalayan crystal salt, and that's actually pink.
Hmm. Now, you did have one great headline. Your drinking water, is it dead or alive? I mean, I've been to the Dead Sea, but I've never been to a wake for water that died. What's dead water?
Well, there's a couple of things. And the primary issue around water is the structure of the water, and the secondary issue around water is whether or not it's actually had anything added to it. And, of course, today, especially if we're drinking tap water, depending on what city we actually live in, we probably have some sort of chemicals added to our water. It's been treated. It's run through pipes that are also themselves treated. And so the actual content of your water is one thing to be concerned about or to be aware of. And the other issue is the structure of the water. And that is actually whether or not the natural structure of your water has been kind of played with because it's had something done to it, whether it's chemicals added, put through certain pipes, that type of thing. It's not unlike if we think about a snowflake, for example. Snowflakes all have certain structures and patterns, and water crystals themselves have patterns as well. And there's a gentleman, a scientist, Dr. Emoto, Masaru Emoto, who has actually published several books about what he calls the hidden messages in water, but he has actually spent many years studying the structure of water, and he's tested water in different cities around the world, and what he has found is that in cities that take care of their water, that have a lot of concern about the water, places actually you wouldn't even imagine, they tend to have much better structure in the water, and the water is better for you. And one of those places is actually, believe it or not, New York City. They have some of the most highly structured water in the world. Places like Tokyo, they don't take a lot of care and effort with their water. When you look at the crystals of water in Tokyo, you can't see any structure at all. And so his hypothesis is, if you don't have structure, then you're really drinking dead water.
Would a whole house water filter solve the problem?
Not really, but there's a couple of things that you can do, but the one that's most highly recommended by most of the people out there who have done a lot of work and research in this water area is something called reverse osmosis, and I can't really explain the details of that to you. It's fairly complex what the actual process does, but today there are companies who actually can come in fact, we actually have this in our house, and most of the vegan as well as organic restaurants that I know I've been to have the same thing, where you can hook up this reverse osmosis mechanism to your own household piping so that all the water that you get for drinking purposes is actually highly structured, and it actually removes anything that, let's say, your particular township or wherever you live that they might be adding to the water. And so that supposedly is the best way to provide water for yourself and your family.
Are you saying that it's hard to get a lot of volume from that so that you don't do it for everything, just for eating and drinking, the meal preparation?
Yeah, pretty much. We're okay with the cooking, drinking. We get it from our sink and all the places where we would possibly drink from, but we don't run it through our shower. And the reason for that is because of the volume. It could be a little different in our place because we happen to have well water. But
bread is baked. Are we going to have to say goodbye to bread?
That's a good question. And that was actually one of the saddest things for my husband. He's an Italian, and giving up pasta was tough for him, and then when he had to give up bread. But in fact, there are ways to make bread using raw preparation techniques. And the most common way to do that is by using a dehydrator. You may have used a dehydrator maybe for dehydrating fruit, or sometimes folks do fruit and vegetables, things like that. Essentially, what you can do is take the types of ingredients that you would utilize to make bread, them together, and then you put them in a dehydrator. You'll never have light, fluffy white bread on a raw food diet, but you can get bread that has an excellent taste to it, a fairly good texture, and it's actually got, maybe, I'm going to say, the height of a quarter to a half an inch is about the highest I've ever seen, whereas, obviously you can have big slices of bread when you're cooking it the usual way. But it's very healthy for you, very easy to digest. We make our bread usually with different types of nuts and seeds. Flaxseed is probably one of the most common things that we grind up. Flaxseed, they dehydrate very well, and all kinds of nice spices. They really serve as a good carbohydrate satisfying food.
For busy people, can you go to Whole Foods and just buy it?
Well, there's a couple of places where you can. Whole Foods, and I can't say all the Whole Foods in the entire country. You really have to get a sense for the Whole Foods in your particular area. But there's a company called Awesome Foods, and that's, I think, at awesomefoods.com. But they supply most of the Whole Foods in the country with carbohydrate raw foods. Actually, it's a husband and wife who started the company, and they did it because they were on a raw food diet, and they really missed carbohydrates. And they've done a wonderful job. They have, I think, six different types of bread: rye bread, zucchini bread, pumpkin bread, and they do a great job. The other option that you have is you can actually buy directly from them, and we do a lot of that too. They'll deliver to your house.
We're talking with Dr. Ruth Ann Russo. Her background includes a master's degree in public health, a doctorate in business administration, and a law degree to boot. A few shows ago, she helped us learn how to get what we need from doctors and healthcare systems. Today, she's sharing her research and love of raw food. Her books are 7 Steps to Your Best Possible Healthcare, and her brand new book that comes out in 2 weeks, The Raw Food Diet Myth. In the meantime, at her website, ruthannrusso.com, that's ruthannrusso.com, you can find excerpts from the book and a lot of other information. If you like this program, then you'll probably love the Defy Aging newsletter. It's free. Every 2 weeks, you get practical advice on how to live longer, healthier, and happier, and a few anti-aging quotes and humor. You can sign up at drbricky.com, that's drbricky.com, or agelesslifestyles.com. Now back to our conversation with Dr. Russo. There are a lot of things I'm confused about, so I want to take the opportunity.
Sure.
I don't understand juicing, because with juicing, you're taking the fiber out, and I thought we needed more fiber in our diets. I know some people say, oh, well, you can use that fiber for other food preparation, but in our household, that's not going to happen. Is there some advantage to juicing?
There's a couple of things, and you make a good point about the fiber. You're actually juicing. You are obviously taking the fiber out, but what you're doing is you're leaving the nutrient-rich liquid part of the fruit or vegetable, depending on what you happen to be juicing, and green vegetables are actually the highest nutrient content when you juice them. By drinking that juice, you are essentially taking in the part of the plant or fruit that actually was already digested by that organism itself. You are essentially allowing your body to take something in that is taking very little effort on the part of your digestive system to process through your body, while at the same time providing you with a huge amount of nutrients, whether it's vitamins, minerals, etc. And again, depending on what you're eating, and that will vary. But so the juicing concept is something that can be actually very healthy for you overall, especially if you're taking juice like first thing in the morning, because it's a great way to sort of introduce your, although most people might sort of be, you know, cringing at the thought of having a green juice in the morning, but obviously you can have fruit juices, that type of thing. And it's something that your body, it's very easy on your body, is giving you some good nutrients, and it's actually being allowed to be processed through your entire digestive system very quickly.
That's part of the marketing problem, too. Green juice and wheatgrass doesn't sound very appealing.
You're right. Even the color green is something that I know, especially with my son's friends when they come over, they're still in high school, and we make green juices, green smoothies, and they're all, you know, rolling their eyes. But I will tell you that if we get to the point where they try the juices or the smoothies, they think they're good. They actually, I have kids who will come to my house now, my son's friends, who will come and ask me to make them a smoothie because they think it tastes so good. Some of them will actually still say to me, I can drink it as long as I keep my eyes closed. So that's just a, you know, conditioning kind of thing that I think we need to get used to. But it really comes down to what can you do to a juice. In most of our juices, we put lemon or lime, and that helps take out a lot of the, what I call the yuck factor, which, unless you're a sadist, I don't think you're going to just drink green juice straight. And so we put lemon or lime, a little bit of ginger root, so it gives a little bit of a kick to it and covers up, again, any of that sort of yuck factor. And in our smoothies, what you're doing is you're putting them in a blender, so we're blending greens, and we put bananas in them. So it's basically just like you're drinking a banana shake, but it's green, so you're getting this extra added benefit from the green part, but you don't really taste it.
I was amazed that the raw food community, it's like Orthodox rabbis arguing about, is this kosher enough, and all kind of controversies, including juicing versus smoothies.
Yes, it's huge. There's a couple of leaders out there who have very polarized ideas. So, for example, Victoria Butenko, who, you know, I call the mother of the raw food movement, who came here from Russia. They weren't sure they were going to get a full meal at the end of the day in Russia because there was such scarcity of food. And they came here, walked into an American grocery store on one of their first trips, and were just mesmerized by all the boxes in the aisles, and they vowed that they would try every box. They were just so excited about all the food. And they did, and within, I think it's a year and a half, her son developed insulin-dependent diabetes, her daughter developed asthma, she developed an arrhythmia, and her husband developed a huge tumor on his thyroid. Everybody was sick. And so she decided that she wanted to find, if possible, a natural way to treat her family because she didn't like what insulin was doing to her son and her husband. They wanted him to have several surgeries. And she went around the state of Colorado, which is where they lived, and decided she was going to look for people who looked healthy and ask them what they did. And she found a woman who had claimed to have cured herself of cancer, who had this radiant glow to her, because most raw foodists do have that sort of, you look maybe a little tan, but it's just a healthy glow. And so this woman gave her some instruction in the basics of raw food, and this is about 20 years ago now. And Victoria went home. Well, she's extreme. She ripped out her microwave from the wall. She got rid of all of her cooking utensils and only would allow her family in the beginning juicing and eating things like just raw carrots and raw fruits and vegetables. She eventually found that what she believes to be the healthiest way to take in your fruits and vegetables from a drinking perspective is the smoothie, what she calls the green smoothie. I think she coined that term. And that is taking the vegetables, and it's really greens, which she's advocating. It's whether you're talking about any dark leafy greens, spinach, it could be romaine lettuce, etc. Dark greens with bananas, and basically putting them in a blender and then drinking that. She has actually hypothesized, and again, there's not a lot of real solid research on this stuff, but we at least have some interesting hypotheses out there. She hypothesizes that we need to keep the fiber in the drink because it helps us keep our hydrochloric acid level correct in our stomach, and then actually helps us lead a healthier life. Now, you can go to the other end of the spectrum, which are people like Brian Clement, who runs the Hippocrates Health Institute down in West Palm Beach, Florida.
Sure. Let me back up a minute. The difference between a smoothie and juicing is what?
The main difference is that you're removing the fiber when you're juicing it, and when you're making it into a smoothie, you're actually putting the entire vegetable, the entire green, whatever it is, into a blender. So you're blending it so that it's still got a consistency of a liquid, but it has the entire piece of the vegetable in it, whatever you happen to be using. And so you, that still retains the fiber. So if you physically look at the actual physical difference would be the juice is a very thin liquid, milkshake consistency.
One of the leap of faith things I'm still struggling with is there's a lot of emphasis on pH balance and being more alkaline. My chemical engineer wife says our stomach is so heavily acid that anything you put in your stomach is just going to get overwhelmed with an acidic pH. What evidence do we have for pH being important?
Generally, the fact that we know that there is a healthy pH balance, and that's really the pH of our blood, even though many of us tend to use the measure that we can get easily from the strips from the drugstore, we check our urine pH, but really the best measure of your pH, which can be gotten, I think, pretty much only through a blood test, but we do know that from just a pure health perspective, and this is no matter who you're talking to, Western medicine folks or raw food people, so is that we're looking for an acid base or a pH level in our blood of 7.35 is, I think, ideal. Anything under that would be acidic. Anything over that would be alkaline. And it's pretty much, I shouldn't say impossible, but fairly difficult to get a high alkaline balance unless you have a certain type of disease. But it's pretty easy, especially with the Western diet that we eat, as you just mentioned, to actually move your pH level into the acidic reading, anything that would be lower than that 7.35. Most of us are in that healthy area. If we weren't, we'd pretty much know it because we wouldn't be feeling very well. But when you look at some of the evidence out there in terms of the harm that can come to us from eating highly acidic foods, there's at least a good argument that we want to focus on trying to eat as much alkaline foods as we possibly can. And I would have to say that probably one of the strongest arguments is some of the research that was done by Otto Warburg, who won the Nobel Peace Prize back in the 1960s. I don't remember the exact year, but he won the Nobel Peace Prize for his work on nutrition and actually the study of the cause of cancer. Mm-hmm. And he focuses a lot on the acid-base balance. And one of the things he found to be most harmful and is also highly acidic is sugar. His piece of work, which, you know, you can get right off the internet on the Nobel Prize website, is very interesting to read in terms of his, not just hypothesis, but actually the studies that he did to prove that cancer cells cannot exist in an alkaline environment that is sugar-free.
If somebody goes to their doctor, can they just say, do a blood test and find out what my pH is?
They can say it, and they can do it. Whether or not your insurance company is going to pay for that is sort of another question for another day.
So if we really want to be conscientious about this, be a good idea to get a blood test before making major changes in a diet and then several months into it and see whether we see a pH difference.
Yes, that's actually a really good idea.
And some of the big successes, although they're largely anecdotal, have been in the area of cancer and diabetes, that people changed to a raw food diet and cancer went into remission, diabetes went into remission. Are there other areas that have had some dramatic results as well?
Those are certainly the two main conditions, but I think a lot of the chronic conditions, I shouldn't say anything, but a lot of the chronic conditions, chronic respiratory conditions, you know, especially in our country where so many folks with asthma or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and there's some evidence, again, not the kind of rigorous research that we really need to see in order to convert to the mainstream, but there is some good information out there about chronic diseases, arthritis. Of course, I mean, just generally, just because obesity is such a huge concern in our society, there's a lot that's been written by some sort of an institute. They're pretty much a, you know, physical location where you can actually go and be, I guess you could say, converted to the raw food lifestyle. Stay anywhere from 2 to 6 weeks was, I guess, you know, sort of the norm, and there's about 4 or 5 of those in the country.
I think you ought to market vacations where maybe you already have this, where you go for a week or two on vacation and it's all appealing raw food and to get people into the habit and to see the benefit, and then they'd be more likely to go back and follow it.
I think there's only one of the organizations that does the conversion, so to speak, that actually has started to make its way into the mainstream a little bit with that exact thing, Dr. Brookie, and that is the Hippocrates Health Institute down in West Palm Beach, Florida. I've actually seen some of their ads. They're like the yogic type magazines where they say some people come to Hippocrates to get healthy some people just come for the food. They show a couple of people that don't look like they're sick, you know, just normal healthy people sitting, eating some of the raw food dishes that they prepare at Hippocrates.
Yeah, you shouldn't have to get cancer or diabetes in order to get the best treatment.
Yeah, exactly. And it's something you can do for yourself. But one of the interesting things that I hear people talk about all the time, when you walk into a raw food restaurant or a raw food store, people will ask you, you know, are you raw? And then they'll say, what percentage are you? I'm 75. I never know how they can calculate that. I'm 75% raw. I'm Dr. Gabriel Cousins, who runs the Tree of Life down in Arizona, says, you know, as long as you can stay on an 80% raw diet, you'll find the same benefits as if you were 100% raw. I still can't figure that out, but it's enough, I think, to at least give people the, you know, the peace of mind to say, well, you know, hey, if I have a little bit of a binge, or if I want to eat a piece of bread or whatever it might be, it's not like I'm losing all the value of the raw food that I'm eating.
You know what the afterlife version of this is, the movie Defending Your Life. They're talking about, well, I'm using 43% of my brain power, and they're all when I'm bragging about brain power percentage. One of the things that I'm still struggling with is, you're very excited about fasting, and I think of fasting is, whoops, there goes the blood sugar level, and I'm very oriented toward one of the things we want to do is keep our blood sugar levels as stable as possible.
Yeah, and that's a good point. And I think I used to feel that way too until, you know, I spent a couple of weeks at the Tree of Life in Arizona with Gabriel Cousins, people working on his new book, which is about diabetes. And they actually have a group of people, 30 people that were in a study. They're all diabetics. Most of them, in fact, the large majority of them were diabetes type 2. But the entire premise of this study was that they took these individuals, you know, recorded what their current insulin levels were in terms of how much insulin they had to take, the whole, you know, sort of gamut in terms of what their normal readings were for blood sugar across any given day, kept all that historical information, and then the first thing that they did was put these individuals on a green juice fast, and they did that for 7 days. And the astounding thing about that was that these folks actually had no issues with their blood sugar. By the end of the study, he's got all the details in his book, but the majority of these folks actually were able to subsist on lower levels of insulin, had much better blood sugar control than prior to actually embarking on the study. And so I think what it comes down to is what you're actually taking in when you do the fasting, the amount of time that you actually are fasting, and how you've actually prepared yourself. So, for example, if you're somebody who is eating what we call the standard American diet, you know, the acronym SAD. And so if you're somebody who's eating that type of a diet, well, you certainly don't want to go on a green juice fast because you will have issues with blood sugar. If you're somebody who's eating good, healthy diet, then the chances that you won't have issues with blood sugar are much greater. I personally don't recommend just undertaking fasting on your own. I think it's scary. And there are many physicians in the country today who do supervised fasting. You know, Joel Fuhrman, who I think was just on the Dr. Oz show just this past week. And he's written several books about fasting. He practices in New Jersey. And he does supervised fasting for patients both in and out of the hospital and has amazing stories of patients who have had all kinds of chronic diseases. In fact, a lot of them with arthritis and respiratory conditions who, once they fasted, their body was actually able to focus on taking care of itself, because there's that saying that if you leave it alone, the human body will figure out a way to take care of itself. It's just that we're always, you know, changing so many things and introducing so many foreign mechanisms into our body that creates a major imbalance. And so his theory, and most of the physicians who do supervised fasting believe that what you're doing is you're giving your entire body a rest to let it repair itself. You're actually sort of like acknowledging the power that your own body has. And some of the stories are great. Again, it's anecdotal. It's not, you know, strong, solid research. So you have to, you know, look at it with a little bit of a jaundiced eye and decide, you know, what works best for you and what you're willing to do or not do.
So if you're going to fast, you do your homework and make sure you know what you're doing. And
absolutely.
Check in with people. I forgot to ask you about something very close to everybody's heart. If we do the raw food and sugar is the big enemy, does that mean we don't have sweetness in our diet anymore?
No, it doesn't mean that. I would have been off this diet and this lifestyle a long time ago if that were the case. In fact, there are many healthy sweeteners, and these are things that, regardless of whether you even want to try doing a piece of the raw food diet lifestyle or not, probably want to at least try to experiment with in your own diet, you know, whether it's for yourself or your kids. I would recommend agave, which looks a little bit like honey, but is a little bit thinner, but sort of the same color and general consistency. And it comes from the agave plant, which used to be grown primarily in South America and Mexico, and now pretty much you can find it at least in the southwestern United States, but you want to get raw agave, and you want to get the dark amber kind. There's light and there's dark. The dark amber kind has a very low blood sugar rating, and that is actually recommended in some places that it can be used by individuals, at least with type 2 diabetes, without any problem. So agave is probably one of the best tasting, easiest to get. You can get it pretty much in almost any grocery store that has an organic section, and you can certainly order it on the internet as well. The other, which is used actually exclusively by individuals like Dr. Gabriel Cousins for his group of people that have diabetes and are enrolled in the study and has no glycemic index at all, it actually has an index of zero, is stevia. And that's actually an herb. That is an herb, and it looks a little bit like a small green leaf, but if you get it, you're probably going to find it that's either dried or powdered. You can also get it in a liquid form. It's got a few other things kind of in there, so I generally like to use the actual leaf or the powder to sweeten when I use it for cooking. Now, that has a little bit of a taste like artificial sweetener, so if you don't like the taste of, let's say, like a Diet Coke, that like aftertaste, you might not like stevia. But again, from a health perspective, that probably is one of the best. So those two, I think, are the most common, and it's, you know, worthwhile to at least give them a try. And you can find stevia also in most of the big grocery stores as well that have an organic section.
And are we giving up caffeine?
You know, on one hand, I want to say yes to a certain extent, but I guess I would be a little bit of a hypocrite to say that, because one of the things that I do is I eat chocolate probably at least a couple times a week, and of course chocolate has caffeine in it. I eat raw chocolate made from the cacao bean that is, you know, raw, organic, etc. So that does have some caffeine in it. To the extent that I will tell you that coffee generally is not seen as something that is part of the raw and living life food style. Tea is, but we actually in our house only drink decaffeinated tea. I think that's really, just like with any of the stuff that we're talking about, it's really an individual choice. And there's always going to be zealots in any type of a movement, and I think this really is a movement, so to speak, who will say, I mean, there are zealots in the raw food movement who say, no caffeine. There are even some who say, no fruit. At the Hippocrates Health Institute, for example, you're only allowed to eat two small bowls of fruit a week. That is the only fruit that you're allowed to get, and that's because they're focused on the fact that sugar of any kind, even in its naturally occurring state, is creating an environment in your body that will allow cancer to exist. And of course, they are very well known for supposedly curing people of cancer who have had no other hope from any other sources. And they literally have thousands and thousands of people who just speak about the wonders that this organization has done. Again, it's anecdotal, not scientifically based research at this point. But, you know, they will tell you as soon as you go there, no sugar in your diet. And that even includes something like fruit. So there's a whole spectrum of philosophies even within this whole raw food diet lifestyle. And it's really a matter, I think what I tried to do in the book was put together as much of the arguments on both sides of the fence as possible, kind of lay out, you know, here's generally what is done in the raw food lifestyle.
You were much more the fair-minded judge than the aggressive attorney.
I tried to be, because it's something that, you know, our family has had a lot of success with, and just talk about it, and other people have kind of converted themselves, because we don't want to be the folks that are running around converting people, because you really need to do it on your own anyway. But we've seen a lot of really positive results, and so I wanted to share the information, but in a way that people can make their own decision. Do I want to do a piece of this? And I've even segmented out the chapter, so you can just read about sweeteners if you want to. Maybe that's a place you want to start, or you can read about pH. Maybe that's a place you want to start to kind of find out what are the things that are really high in acid and what do I want to potentially stay away from. Start anywhere.
We focus today on health benefits. I do want to point out that this has a very spiritual dimension too. Several years ago, I decided to stop eating meat and to rarely eat dairy. And after a few years, I found that, gee, I wouldn't want to eat meat because I wouldn't want to do that to animals. There's a spiritual consciousness that goes with this. And what you describe in the book is it's very pervasive and very deep and very rich.
In terms of?
Being mindful when you eat every morsel of food.
Right, right. It's really the vegan lifestyle that has been incorporated into this as well. And it's being very aware of your eating. And then it's also even anything that you are purchasing, or the vegan lifestyle says essentially that we are not going to utilize for our own advantage any product of an animal because we don't want to interfere with their ability to live a healthy life. And so that means what we're eating, what we're wearing, anyone who practices the vegan lifestyle isn't going to wear leather, for example, or even silk because it's, you know, made by silkworms, or even eat honey, actually, because that's made by the saliva of bees is used in the production of honey. So it goes, you know, to some pretty far extremes. And again, it's what works for you.
You're a wonderful guide and even-handedly helping us wade in and pick and choose and get our feet wet. We're talking with Dr. Ruth Ann Russo, who has a background with public health and a doctorate in business administration, a law degree, and a few shows ago helped us learn how to advocate with doctors and healthcare systems. And today she's been teaching us about raw food and the raw food movement. Her books are Seven Steps to Your Best Possible Healthcare, and coming out in 2 weeks, The Raw Food Diet Myth. Information is at her website, ruthannrusso.com, RUTHANNRUSSO.com. Dr. Russo, wonderful getting some orientation and answers, and really appreciate you sharing with us.
Well, I'm happy to be able to share the information, and thanks so much for having me, Dr. Brickey.
Delighted to have you. The focus of this program is helping you live longer, healthier, and happier. My particular expertise is in anti-aging psychology, or what I call the anti-aging ABCs, the attitudes, the beliefs, and the coping skills that help people think, feel, look, and be more youthful. I readily acknowledge that I am not an expert on nutrition, and while I'm trying to improve my eating habits, I'm certainly no role model for good nutrition. So with that disclaimer, what are we to make of the raw food movement? I think that nutrition is the most confusing part of anti-aging. We have nutrition gurus that tell us to eat mostly carbohydrates, and others telling us to eat lots of fat and protein, and others to eat meat, and others tell us to eat raw eggs. Then we have people telling us to eat for our blood type, or eat according to our ethnic heritage, or our temperament. Food combining tells us that we're not supposed to mix different types of foods at one meal. We're told to follow a Mediterranean diet, an Okinawan diet, and many other diets. We even have an Indian tradition and prominent celebrities and politicians who have followed the practice of drinking their urine. It's difficult to know what to conclude from this cacophony of information about nutrition. Let's take a look at the raw food movement. It appears to be a very healthy diet because of its emphasis on fresh fruits, fresh vegetables, and nuts, and the care and the love that advocates give to being mindful when they eat also contributes to it being healthy. The culture that goes with its appreciation of meditation, of being mindful, and its reverence for nature, all contribute to good health in addition to the benefits of the food. We don't have a lot of good scientific data supporting the raw food diet or contradicting the raw food diet. This is probably analogous to not having a lot of good research on herbs and on medications that aren't patentable. If raw food becomes more popular and more mainstream, we may see more money flowing into research. Personally, I think it's a big leap from the Curlian photography to concluding that not cooking food is going to be healthier. I spoke with some critics of the raw food movement, and their take was that the energy in the Curlian photography is probably germs, and that's not something that you want in your food, that one of the benefits of cooking is to kill germs. One of their arguments, which seemed like a stretch to me, was that if cooking does kill energy, that would lead to less free radical oxidation. They also make the argument that the stomach is so acidic it's going to deactivate enzymes anyway. Finally, I would note that there is a considerable controversy about whether raw food contributes to dental problems. It could be that raw vegetables and nuts are a little harder on teeth, or it could be that raw food advocates who tend to sip fruit juices all day long or munch on dry fruit and trail mixes throughout the day are keeping a constant source of sugar in their mouth, and that acid is wearing on their teeth. So what can we conclude? Well, most of us would do well to eat more fruits and vegetables and probably to eat more of them raw. Secondly, it's certainly worth trying some fruit juices and smoothies and raw food dishes and see whether you like them and whether they help you feel good or feel healthier. Third, if you've been struggling with a particular health problem, it's probably worth trying a raw food diet to see if it helps. This is particularly true with diabetes and cancer, since raw food seems to have a particularly good track record with those diseases. Fourth, it's not a yes-no choice between raw food and the standard American diet. There's a huge continuum in between, including various types of vegetarian diets. Fifth, the raw food movement is a lifestyle as well as a way of eating. And if you resonate with that lifestyle, you're going to enjoy the food and the lifestyle so much more. And if that lifestyle is an anathema to you, you're going to feel a little out of step. For example, I checked out the webpage for the Hippocrates Life Change Program, and a sample daily schedule has meditation, exercise, breakfast green juice, lecture, late morning green juice, lunch buffet, lecture, afternoon green juice, dinner buffet, and activity or lecture or movie, plus wheatgrass juice twice a day. Now, if that sounds like a perfect vacation to you, you're probably going to really love the natural food lifestyle. If this sounds like a nightmare vacation to you, you're probably going to always feel out of step. Finally, when it comes to nutrition, the most important thing is what your body needs, and what your body needs is very different from what other people's bodies need. So you need to listen to your body, use your own scientific method, and see what makes you feel more energetic, what makes you feel healthier, and to the contrary, what causes problems in your health, and try to eat accordingly. What's the downside? Well, it's a little like keeping kosher. First of all, it can be very expensive. Organic food, of course, is a little more expensive than non-organic food. I've done the website for Awesome Foods, and the raw food bread was $4.25 for 4 ounces. That would come to $17 a pound. Pretty expensive for bread. Another downside, of course, is that it limits where you can eat and even where you can shop, which in turn can be a little limiting socially. I noted that it's quite possible that raw foods might become as popular as organic foods have become. Just today, I heard on the radio that Coke is planning on putting stevia in one of its Coke products. Also, I can't help but wonder, gee, if John Wayne or Gary Cooper and those Westerns had stepped up to the bar and ordered some wheatgrass, we might have millions of Americans eating raw food and drinking green juices. A little housekeeping, I did put the websites that Dr. Russo referred to on agelesslifestyles.com. Also, I don't know if we operationally defined what cooking meant in raw food. Also, I don't know if we operationally defined what cooking means to raw food advocates. It means not heating the food above 110 degrees Fahrenheit. And Dr. Russo referred to Kirlian photography, that's spelled K-I-R-L-I-A-N. Wikipedia has an interesting discussion on it. Or if you do a web search on Kirlian photography food or something like that, you'll find several sites that have photographs. The purpose of Ageless Lifestyles Radio is to help people think, feel, look, and be more youthful. And one of the things I always like to do is to challenge people to do a baby step, some little tweak that incorporates the kind of thing that our guest talked about. Today's is really a no-brainer. It's a cafeteria of choices. Try some stevia instead of sugar. Try some raw salt. Try some green juice or a smoothie. Check out a raw food restaurant, or if you don't have one in your community, a local Whole Foods or other organic food store may have a juice bar or serve food. The bottom line is to try a few things, see what you think, and see whether you feel any differently. Nutrition is so important to our health, it's certainly worth checking it out and giving it a try. Well, now it's time for email, and as you know, I love emails. Send those emails to radio@agelesslifestyles.com. That's radio@agelesslifestyles.com. Some of the emails I received on last week's show with Dr. Zelikoff asked, well, I'm confused. Am I supposed to get an annual physical or not? My understanding was that most of Dr. Zelikoff's concern about cascading tests and wild goose chases centered around cardiograms and stress tests for people who didn't have cardiac symptoms, body scans, CAT scans, and similar tests. I don't recall him having any criticism of blood tests, and I think blood tests are a very efficient way of getting a profile on how you're doing and identifying some problems early. Also note that Dr. Zelikoff did recommend that everyone, even if they don't have symptoms, have a colonoscopy once after the age of 50. I think we've hit here on one of the weaknesses of our healthcare system, or what I actually refer to as our disease care system. The focus is on correcting problems that are already identified rather than preventing problems. Ideally, that annual physical should take a good look at nutritional practices and the effects of those nutritional practices, and a good look at our exercise and whether that is meeting our physical needs. There's nothing stopping you from doing this. There's a lot of good instruments and tests and quizzes available. It's just not currently coming from our physicians. I think a good example of what our system would be doing if we were practicing more prevention is the work that John Erickson is doing to do balance testing with seniors. For the very small cost of testing balance, we can identify seniors who are at risk for having falls, which are very devastating to the person's health and well-being, as well as very expensive financially. Again, I love getting those emails. Send them to radio@agelesslifestyles.com. And if you like the kind of ideas that you get from Ageless Lifestyles Radio, do subscribe to the Defy Aging newsletter. Just hop on to drbricke.com, drbricke.com, or agelesslifestyles.com and sign up. It's free, and it's good practical advice that you can use. This is Dr. Michael Bricke with Ageless Lifestyles Radio on webtalkradio.net, thanking you for joining us on our journey to live longer, healthier, and happier.